Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Delighted to have you with us for Here and Now Anytime, where we give you both the news you need to know today, along with stories that will stick with you tomorrow. So be sure to subscribe and follow. We've got lots ahead right now.
Trump's argument was that he shouldn't have to pay until after his appeal. New York's argument was he should pay it all before he appeals. And then today comes along and the court ordered Trump to put up a bond for $175 million.
Today, an appeals court cut the amount Trump has to come up with to appeal that massive business fraud judgment against him. And it gives him 10 more days to come up with the cash. Monday, March 25th, 2024. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Shirley Jahan. On the show today, it is 3 weeks till tax day, Monday, April 15th, coming up. Now might be a good time for a little spring cleaning, getting your financial house in order. And we've got helpful tips just for you. And then, the value of gathering with friends, creating community, and talking books, book clubs, making them, and making them great. First up, a New York appeals court just lightened the load for former President Donald Trump to appeal his business fraud case. Trump now has to come up with $175 million for that appeal, and he gets 10 more days to do it. Trump still faces a nearly $500 million fine for committing persistent business fraud. New York Attorney General Letitia James says that judgment still stands. Will Thomas is an expert on white-collar crime. He's a business law professor at the University of Michigan, and he talks with Scott Tong about what the new appeal bond means and what happens next.
All right, so let's talk about this business fraud case where Trump and his company lost last month. It owes $454 million. Trump has to either come up with that money or come up with what's called an appeal bond for a portion of it. What's an appeal bond?
Well, so we all know that if you lose a trial, you can appeal that decision. And part of what you have to do to appeal is what lawyers call furnish an undertaking, which basically means you're going to provide the appellate court with proof that you can and will pay an entire trial judgment if you ultimately lose. Easily the most common way that people do this is by getting an appeal bond. So the appeal bond here is a little bit like insurance, except where an insurance policy pays me if I get injured, the bond is essentially going to pay the other party if I'm the one who injured them. So what we would have here is some third party saying, Trump has promised us he's going to pay his legal bills, but if for some reason he doesn't, we, the bond company, are going to step in and make sure that money gets paid.
Yeah, all right. So what changed today was Trump got 10 extra days to come up with bond money, and it's much less money. We should note he would still have to pay the full judgment if he loses on appeal. What is the logic today, the explanation from the appeals court, reducing the money and delaying it?
I would say today's decision strikes me as the kind of equitable compromise that courts do a lot, and that makes sense if we just don't think too hard about it. If we boil down the dispute, the state of New York won a trial against Trump for roughly $350 million plus a lot of interest. Trump's argument was that he shouldn't have to pay any of that until after his appeal. New York's argument was he should pay it all before he appeals. And then today comes along and the court ordered Trump to put up a bond for $175 million, which is almost exactly 50% of that original trial judgment number before interest. So to me, this is about as close as courts get to a Solomonic compromise.
Yeah. Now, just to be clear, again, if Trump loses on appeal, he would have to pay the full judgment amount. If he does lose, what would his options be to pay?
That's correct. So if he does lose, he would have to pay the original trial judgment amount plus pre-trial interest and also interest that is accruing from now until the appeal itself is finalized. So that number could continue to go up day by day. If he loses at this level, he has one more opportunity to appeal, so he may be able to win at the highest court in New York. But putting that aside, what he'd be facing is a fairly substantial judgment that could be paid either in cash, marketable securities, or as we've sort of seen over the past several days, maybe some of his New York real estate would be seized by the Attorney General, and used to pay that judgment.
Yeah, and that was my next question for you. New York Attorney General Letitia James, as far as the process of beginning the process to seize his assets, what might that process look like? Have we had any initial signals?
We've actually already seen a little bit of that happening in the background. So there are a bunch of minor but important steps that you have to go through to actually carry out a legal judgment. And one of those steps is notifying the court in the local jurisdiction where property is that you have this ruling and that you're planning to do something with it. We saw James doing that last week. She filed her trial judgment in jurisdictions where several of Trump's New York golf courses were located, which suggests that James is not really looking at some of the Manhattan properties like Trump Tower, but was really focusing more on some of the farther out real estate like the golf courses that in some respects are a little bit less complicated to grab.
Yeah, okay. And just briefly, Will, as far as choices, Donald Trump could sell properties, but he could also declare bankruptcy. Is that correct?
He could absolutely declare bankruptcy. And in some respects, declaring bankruptcy is the classic move in this situation. If you remember back several years ago when Gawker Media was sued by Hulk Hogan, Gawker lost a very massive trial judgment, couldn't raise the money for appeal, and so filed for bankruptcy in order to allow it to go forward with its appellate process. That's an avenue that Donald Trump legally could pursue, but he staked so much of his identity and brand on this claim that he's never declared bankruptcy. I struggle to imagine a world where he takes that path.
Yeah. All right. We've been talking to Will Thomas of the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Will, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, when it comes to your business dealings, what to keep, what to shred, what to drag and drop into the trash. We've got some great tips for you on cleaning up your financial house this tax season. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com.
How do we dust off those old mortgage files, clear out the gutters of our utility bills, power wash perhaps, those tax documents? Well, here to save us from bad metaphors and give us some good advice is Jill Schlesinger, business analyst at CBS News and the host of Jill on Money. Hey, Jill.
Hello. And also, just like for today, Felix, as in Oscar and Felix, the clean one.
Oscar Madison. Okay, Jill. Well, let's be the neat person in the apartment and talk taxes first. April 15 is looming, and as I look up those tax files in our house, should I throw out the really old ones? How long do I need to keep these papers?
Let's stick to 6 years, and here's why. The IRS can audit you for basically the last 3 years, but if they find a big error, they can add on additional years. And when I speak to folks at the IRS, they generally say they don't go back more than 6 years. So keep your returns, all the supporting documents for 6 years just to be safe. That's your line in the sand.
Yeah. All right. So as we're doing our taxes, we're pulling up all these statements, right? These documents, a lot of them are online. Utility bills, credit card bills, financial statements, bank statements are all online now. Am I okay, Jill, to leave them online, or should I download or print out a bunch of them just so I have them?
I mean, I love doing everything electronically. If you need something over the last year, you can usually find that bill. But I would print out anything you think you might need for the next tax season. So, you know, maybe you put something on your credit card, you sponsored your friend for a bike ride and it hit your credit card. You might want that if you're an itemized, use itemized deductions. Or maybe you want to save something that's associated with your house, maybe for warranty purposes. So maybe just print those things out. And for the rest, when I say get rid of, just to know for everybody, when I say get rid of, I don't mean throw out, I mean shred. So please, if you have physical documents, we want a shredder.
Yeah, shred why?
Well, I mean, listen, you throw stuff out right now and there are thieves just waiting. So the best practice is anything that has any personal information into the shredder, it goes. If you don't have a shredder, they're very cheap. Or just go use one of your friends who works at a big firm somewhere and throw it in their shredder.
Yeah. All right. So, right. Some of the things we do on, as you say, we're going to shred them, get rid of some stuff we don't need anymore. But how about the stuff in my file cabinet? I have to pull out and I have to blow out the dust. They've been there so long. I'm talking about old mortgage home sale papers. Do I keep those forever?
If you still live in the home, I keep everything from, say, a property deed, your home inspection, the warranty, the survey. I keep any information about home improvements or major purchases, and also mortgage documents for as long as you hold the mortgage. If you've paid your mortgage off 10 years ago, you don't need the note anymore. Otherwise, the other stuff you should actually keep.
Yeah. Okay. And finally, any additional parting words of wisdom as we're all going through our financial documents, paying our taxes, and figuring out what we got to keep?
Well, I think forever keepers, birth and death certificates, social security cards, marriage licenses and divorce decrees, military discharge papers, and estate documents. If you have these physical documents, make digital copies of them. And once you have that, put them in a fireproof safe. Did everyone hear that? Fireproof safe. Don't market important documents. That's what thieves love. They love to find your with a big arrow that says, oh, and the good jewelry's over there.
All right. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst. Thank you as always.
Take care.
Coming up in just a moment, where can you go for deep discussions, tasty snacks, and some great company? A book club may be the key. Stay with us as we dive into the power of books to build community.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why Betterment believes cash can be a strategic choice.
There are times when the market is volatile, when customers are a little nervous about investing. We came to understand that there was an opportunity to introduce cash as part of an investing strategy and to give back yields to the customer.
Learn more about high-yield cash accounts at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed. Cash reserve offered through Betterment LLC and Betterment Securities. Betterment is not a bank. Support for NPR and the following message come from Bombas. Bombas makes absurdly soft socks, underwear, and T-shirts. And for every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness. Get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/NPR and use code NPR.
If spring is a time for new life, new beginnings, have you ever thought about birthing a book club? Come on, I know some of you have. Well, how many people should you have? How do you pick the books? Do you go for safe books that most people are going to actually want to read? And how might a book club go off the rails? Well, we've got the person with some answers, or at least some thoughts. Tracy Thomas is creator and host of the podcast The Stacks and a regular on our show. Tracy, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So What's good and perhaps not good about being in a book club?
Well, I think what's not good, we'll start there, yeah. is that you have to read whatever your group decides they want to read. And sometimes yeah. that can be a book that you're not interested in. So I think for me, that's what's not good. I think what's good is you can get so much more out of a book from talking to other people about it, regardless of what you thought of it, regardless of what they thought, just hearing different opinions, different insights on characters or writing style, or even what happened, and then someone in the book club maybe can cheat and tell you the answer.
Yeah, right, right. No, I've been there. I'm in a book club. My wife and I, plus one other couple, decided maybe 5-6 years ago, you know, let's try it. Let's enhance our relationship with others in our kind of circles. And still going, we have about 12 people now. And as I heard you talk about that, what I found interesting is perhaps the books that get the most discussion are the ones that a lot of us didn't really like, but we're like, you know, what was it about? What did I miss? What was the author perhaps trying to say? But Tracy, how do you think about numbers? How many people is a good number or range?
My first ever book club was me and one other friend, which was barely a book club. And then my second ever book club was my podcast, The Stacks. We have a book club. And now when we do our virtual book club meetups, there's about 50 to 60 people.
Oh, wow.
So I've never had a mid-range book club experience. I've either had me and one or me plus 60. So I might not have the correct answer here. I think ideally, if you're meeting in person, no more than 12, you know, but I think, you know, life happens. So I don't know if everybody comes to every book club meeting.
Yeah, yeah, they don't for ours. Yeah, so we often get, right, 8, 9, 10 or so. How does it work with 60? How do people weigh in your large book club?
Yeah, so my book club jokes because they call me a bully, which is true. We do it over Zoom, and we've all read the book. I do a podcast episode about the book with a guest, and then a week later, we jump on this Zoom, and people talk, but part of the reason people talk is because I tell them if they don't talk, I'm going to call on them.
Oh, you're one of those. Wow, and you sound so nice.
Well, I mean, with 60 people, you really want to get people's different opinions, and a lot of the most interesting and thoughtful opinions do come from people who are kind of quiet and sitting in the back and don't want to say anything. And so I like to be upfront about that and say, look, I want everybody to talk. There's 60 of us. Let's all actually try and have a conversation. So sometimes it's a back and forth between two people for a few minutes. Sometimes it's different people offering their opinion. Other folks ask questions. They say, I really want to talk about this topic. So I think it works like every other book club, but there's definitely a little bit more facilitating on my part, or I say facilitating, they say bullying. It's really
right, yeah. Well, no, I mean, the argument is, right, if you, I mean, you joined, you chose to do this, so do it. I mean, I guess that's the argument for how to pick books. Like in our Make It Up As We Figure It Out group, we initially had a vote. Everybody nominated one or two books, and we had a vote on 12 for the upcoming year, one per month. And later on, we said, you know what? We have 12 people. We're just going to have each person pick one. And we got this huge variety. What do you think works as to how to pick books?
I think that's exactly the way that it should work, is that the group either votes on books or each person gets to pick one book, no questions asked. Another way that I've heard that sounds really great and sort of a mix of the two is that when it's your month, Scott, you pick three books you would really want to read, and then the group votes on those three books. Mm. That way, you know for sure you're going to be excited when it's your month, but also everyone's going to be excited, because I have heard horror stories of like, Amy always picks these horrible books that nobody wants to read, you know? So this way it's sort of everybody gets to weigh in. And then whoever's book it is, they are in charge of facilitating, you know, bringing questions, being sort of in charge of the setup.
Okay. Any other, just kind of coming back to the how to start something up, other tips for how to think about it, how to reach out to people, how to communicate, how to meet in the flesh or Zoom, all of those questions?
Well, I think the most important thing when starting a book club or anything where you're asking for people's time is to be clear on what the expectation is. I know some book clubs, nobody reads the book, and that's fine if everybody's on the same page. I know some book clubs, you can't come unless you finished the book. So just setting up really clearly what the expectation is for you and your book club. I personally think that people who don't finish the book should certainly be able to come to book club, because sometimes they have insight. Like, I got to page 100 and I was so turned off by this character. I just couldn't finish it. And that can often prompt some really exciting stuff too. And usually because book club isn't really always about the details of the plot, it's usually about themes and ideas. If you haven't finished, you can still have thoughts about those kinds of things. So I am sort of flexible with that. But I do also say at the start of my book club, if we read a novel that month, there will be spoilers in this conversation. So if you're here, the expectation is you're okay with that, you know, but being really clear about what the expectations are. We're going to meet in person for 6 months and we're going to meet virtually for 6 months, and letting people come and go as they feel comfortable. As long as the expectations are clear, I think you're in for a successful book club.
Does it have to be someone you think in charge? No, you're the boss of your book club. And I can imagine, right, at book club meetings, it can help if somebody's designated in charge. On the other hand, these are my friends, right? I don't always want to have a boss at book club. I have a boss already. I just want a casual conversation.
I think you should have a boss for each book club, but I love the idea of the boss changing. Whoever's book it is, they're the boss for that. Whoever suggested the book, they take leadership. Or if you do it at someone's house, whoever's house you're at, they're the boss for that particular month. Doesn't mean that they're the boss of you or that they're your boss friend. It just means in April, we're at Scott's house.
Yeah.
Scott picked the book. Scott is going to set up the questions. Scott's kind of going to lead and facilitate, make sure we hit the topics we want to hit, and kind of just be more of a facilitator than a boss, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So I have to ask, how can book club meetings go off the rails? Let us count the ways. I mean, I imagine, and some of this may be from real life, you know, people going off on tangents. There are over talkers and there are under talkers. What comes to mind for you for how it can go badly and how to bring it back on the rails?
I mean, I think the number one way for me that it goes bad is when someone talks too much. You know, the person who's like going on and kind of thinking as they're going and kind of spirals out. That's my personal book club pet peeve. I think that sometimes if the book choice is a little dull for conversation, that can be really challenging because you kind of, you know, boy meets girl, fall in love, get married, the end. It's like, okay, well, there's not a lot to talk about here. So I think sometimes book selection can end up hurting book club down the line. Those are my two biggest ways they can go off the rails. But I will say, in one of our most recent book club conversations, we did something where we talked about like our personal lives a little bit more, and it ended up being a really fulfilling conversation about how we show up in community. So I think being flexible, being open to the whims of the conversation, you know, if you're really listening to what people are saying, often you can tell that maybe we don't need to stick so tightly to the text this time. Maybe we can talk a little bit more broadly.
Any other example of like a great moment or a difficult moment in your book club?
Yes, I have a great moment in our book club. We read A Mercy by Toni Morrison, which is a super challenging novel. Our book club meetups are usually 60 minutes or so. We were at about minute 50, and all of a sudden, one of the women in the book club brought up this topic about the Bible. And then I started riffing, and then someone else started riffing. And by the time we finished, we were like, oh my God, we cracked the entire novel. I'm getting chills thinking about it right now. I was so excited. It was such a thrilling experience to be talking for an hour. And then all of a sudden, all the pieces coming together and being like, you said this and you said that. And I think she was doing this with the Bible, and just like really kind of like sleuthing this super challenging novel as a group. It was so much fun.
Yeah, I like it. We've been getting book club advice from Tracy Thomas, host and creator of the podcast The Stacks, and she has suggestions for book club books, and we'll have the list on our site, hereandnow.org. Tracy, thanks as always. Happy reading.
Thank you.
And we've also got a variety of great reading, authors, and book selections for you right at our website on our Here and Now bookshelf. Just go to hereandnow.org. This podcast comes to you thanks to the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Today's stories are produced by Jill Ryan, Thomas Danielian, and Emiko Tamagawa. Our editors are Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, and Kat Welsh. Technical directors are Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and Chris Bentley created the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. I'm Shirley Jihad. Thank you for being with us. And subscribe. We'll see you tomorrow.
This message comes from Schwab. It's easy to invest in ideas you believe in with Schwab Investing Themes, like online music and videos, artificial intelligence, and electric vehicles. Choose from over 40 customizable themes. More at schwab.com.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rosetta Stone, the perfect app to achieve your language learning goals no matter how busy your schedule gets. It's designed to maximize study time with immersive 10-minute lessons and audio practice for your commute. Plus, tailor your learning plan for specific objectives, like travel. Get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off and unlimited access to 25 language courses. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.